You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, the hiatus is over. Hunter Motz, Brian the Kid Callen, back, bringing you the best and the brightest as we mediate, as we behave as the bridge from those great minds to your puny civilian minds.
Now, Brian, it's anytime you want someone. Much? Well, I just always think that it's smart when you want someone to pay attention to you to insult them.
Don't call them puny and civilian minds. Yeah. Ah, damn it. I'm sorry, guys. I've just been out there just living hard, if you know what I mean. Surfing, lifting, taking boxing way too seriously.
Uh-huh.
I box about 5 days a week. Brendan Schaub, yeah, who the UFC heavyweight, looked at me and said, Brian, look at me. What he goes, you will never be a boxer. It's over. And I was like, I know. But in my mind, I was like, I don't know.
But the great thing is that, you know, Brendan has an intervention on air and it's highly successful.
Right.
You know, millions. Yours is off air and makes no impact.
Makes zero impact. And he really got in my face. He like really cares about me. My boxing coach wants me to take a smoker, like actually fight, you know, a guy. And he's like, I'm not letting you do that. I'm not letting you get hurt. And he's right. Anyway, my ego is very big, ladies and gentlemen. I'm back. It hasn't changed at all. We have Jean-Pierre Oquet, who is the High Commissioner for Refugees, coming up. But in the meantime, Hunter, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Brian. How are you?
I'm good, man. We've done a lot of we're working on this TV show, Hunter and I, and so that's kind of why we've been MIA. I got involved in The Fighter and the Kid, 1.8 million downloads. Thank you very much. The point is, America needs me in other venues.
It's true, Brian.
But I missed this. I miss the fact that there are very few areas and venues to talk about the things that matter. You and I are always talking about how difficult it is to get ideas to have to mix, to migrate, and to permeate. And it's hard for all of us, man, because we all have these built-in belief structures that are predicated or at least also built on emotion.
Yeah, but it's fun seeing those broken. I mean, I think, you know, the success of Malcolm Gladwell, the Freakonomics guys, yeah, like people love having their worldview turned upside down, shaken around a bit, and then coming to a new worldview.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, that's very true. And yeah, that's the biggest thing. Yeah. And I think that the march of human progress, and there is progress, and there is a march toward that.
Who's in front of that progress, Brian?
I am, obviously.
Oh, okay.
But the march of that is what happens, it seems, that ideas do kind of, at the end of the day, they go, these military dictatorships aren't really working in Latin America. Let's try a messy democracy, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think the danger is always, though, is that there's a ping-ponging back and forth between two bad ideas.
Like,
I mean, The UN has a series of Arab Human Development Reports, which I have mentioned before on this podcast, and they one of the points they make is that the Arab world seems to be trapped between two bad ideas, Islamic fundamentalism and, you know, dictatorships.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a tendency to ping pong back and forth between them. And I think, you know, in part, the United States is responsible for that, because when they then go and try democracy, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't work out, but that's because there's a stage before democracy, which is rule of law. And the Arab world has never really had rule of law. They've never had a situation where the leader has even had to obey the law.
Yeah, man. Know? That's a huge, huge problem. I pulled, just as I was talking to you, the thickest hair, an elephant hair, out of my face. Ladies and gentlemen, before we get into anything, let me just talk about a sponsor of ours, Casper.
Uh-huh.
You and I have some experience with Casper mattresses.
Different experiences, Brian.
Well, my experience is I sleep on one every single night. Casper is so confident in their product that they sponsored my other podcast, and they sent me a mattress for free.
And then what happened to that mattress, Brian?
Well, it got to the door. I was off doing something, and you ended up dragging it upstairs to my bedroom where all the lovemaking goes on.
With your father-in-law. That was a pretty awkward moment.
Yeah.
Like moving a new mattress.
Your daughter's about to be taken on this mattress at least twice a month when the kids are asleep and you're feeling up to it for probably a total of 10 minutes. The point is, this guy's an animal. Good thing there's memory foam. But I got to tell you, I really appreciate this company because they believe in their product. Like, it's pretty cool that they send you a mattress. And let me give you an example. Let me tell you kind of why I like this company. And I never do any, you know, basically any advertisements for things I don't believe in. But they engineered it. It's ridiculously cheap compared. Most mattresses cost over $1,500. You can get, a twin size for $500. You can get a twin XL for $600. You can get a full size for $750 and a queen for $850. And what I sleep on, a king size, because I'm the king, is $950. I didn't pay for it. But I got to tell you, I had some very expensive mattresses. I was super expensive mattress from another company because I had a publicist, and they gave me, they said it's $3,800. Mm-hmm. And it was unbelievable and all that. You know what's better? And I got rid of it, the Casper. I exchanged it for the Casper. Because when I slept on the Casper, for whatever reason, maybe it's my back, it didn't hurt. And it feels really comfortable. I'm talking way too much about this. I'm supposed to do this but I just want to talk about it for a second because I think it's interesting. It's got two technologies. It's got latex foam and memory foam. I don't know what that means. I just know it makes it a lot better. And here's the cool thing. This is how confident they are in the product. You can sleep on a Casper for 100 days with free delivery and painless returns. You can return it. It's a risk-free trial, okay? Sleep on it for 100 days. If you don't like it, send it back. Okay, by the way, mattress made in America. Mm. Yeah. So if you're sleeping on an American mattress. So $500 for twin size mattress, $950 for a king size mattress. And just compare the difference. There's no comparison. And they are as good as any mattress on the planet. So I'm gonna give you something to do here. You can go to Casper.com/BCS, which is the Brian Callen Show, and you get $50 toward any mattress purchase. All right, so visit www.casper.com/BCS, Brian Callen Show, and you'll get $50 off. And Hunter, I want to say on air that any money I make, I give to you and Mike Casantini.
Well, Mike and I have, you could say that on air, but is that what actually happens?
I just want the people to know that I'm super generous.
That you have largesse. Well, I would also like to say about Casper mattresses that they're not only good for the king's back, they're also good for the king's movers' backs, because it's actually quite a light mattress to move. It's an easy one to install.
Yeah, it comes like, I didn't see it, but you told me it comes in like a tiny package or something?
Yeah, it comes rolled up in a box, like a Tootsie Roll or you know, a Fruit Loop.
How big is the box?
Something. I mean, I don't know.
It can fit in your pocket, ladies and gentlemen.
No, it's not that small, but it's pretty small. I mean, you know, you can hug the box. So
really?
If you want something to spoon with as well, like it comes with something to sleep on and something to spoon with if you live alone.
There you go. I like that.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah. You go to mattress stores, you have to lie on them all the time. Like, you just lie on them and it's like, okay, I don't know. You never know. I do know that it's funny how technology and the internet is making everything a lot more accessible and cheap.
Yeah,
you don't
100%.
Get better. Yeah, I like that you can shop for a mattress and underwear and socks on the internet, and there are companies that make really good products.
Yeah, and that you no longer have to leave your house. You can just be a total shut-in.
That's right. A complete agoraphobe.
Yeah.
Is it agoraphobe?
Agoraphobe. Because it's the same word as agora, as in like the marketplace, as in, you know, where you would debate things.
Jesus.
So there you go.
Hunter, what did you go to Harvard?
I mean, I went there, but only for like a quick tour.
Yeah.
Which was linguist. Cool. Because they had, I'm a cunning linguist.
Yes.
The worst joke in the world.
The worst joke, but you know, you intellectuals and your humor.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're waiting for Jean-Pierre Hocquet.
Yep, he's going to call.
I'm looking forward to asking him some questions. Like he was the High Commissioner for Refugees, United Nations High Commissioner. He was the Director of Operations, I think, for...
the International Committee of the Red Cross.
Yeah. Responsible for 17 million refugees worldwide. There are a lot of stories about how he probably would admit this, but he directly, you know, went to people like Castro and got Castro to put pressure on Angola to let some seeds
get
through.
We'll get him to tell that story. We'll get him to tell that story.
And saved some lives, man. I've never done anything like that. I saved life with my comedy.
That's...
Oh, by the way, speaking of which, I'll be in San Francisco this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, at the Punchline Comedy Club.
Yeah.
So, come
Brian, tell me about a time that you saved somebody's life with your comedy.
We were pinned down, And
I'm pinned down by gunfire one of those old heavy mattresses.
I remember one time I was with this girl and I was on vacation and she was a lot younger than me. I didn't realize that. In fact, she might have been, I don't know. She was like 19 and I was like 50. And no, I was
like Johnny Depp and his wife.
Yeah, I was like 33 or something. Yeah. And she was like way too young. I didn't know. She told me she was 23 and turned out mm-hmm. she was even younger. And we were in this room and we were getting it on and her dad knocked on the door and I hid in the bathtub. Now, I didn't save any lives, but I just remember...
You saved your own life.
...hiding in the fucking bathtub, this dirtbag that I was, fully adult. The guy was probably only like 10 years older than I was. And then he left, and I went back.
But was comedy responsible
nope.
for...
No, see, no, so I didn't have... The answer is I just wanted to tell some dirtbag story about myself and that had no relevance to your question whatsoever. I just had a flashback to a terrifying time when I was pinned down in a bathtub.
Is that because you don't have any stories where you save somebody's life with comedy, or is it because you're so modest because it happens all the time, but you don't like to brag?
Yes. Yes. Yes, that's right.
Okay, excellent.
I was trying to think of the amount of time I spend wishing my shoulders were broader and that I was just 25 pounds heavier. Like, I want to be imposing.
Well, I mean, just so that the listeners know, we're looking at a giant picture of Brian Callen on a video monitor, yeah. which is appropriate.
Not but a bad picture either.
It's a great picture. But the question is, do you wish that your shoulders were broader? Is it really that you would just like to stretch everything a little bit and yeah. then have the same size head? Because presumably yeah. once you make the shoulders broader, now you got to make the neck broader.
Yeah, but
now you got to change all sorts of dimensions.
No, the head is fine. I guess, the kind of body that Patrick Rafter had, if you remember the tennis player. He won Wimbledon. That's the guy, just 6'3", mm-hmm. with a long femur bone and mm-hmm. just long, easy, powerful limbs. Mm. So there it is. I'm glad we're talking about things that really matter here. Let's get back to changing the world and the ideas that we always talk about. You know, you were witness to a knockdown, drag-out fight I had with Patty Jenkins, who is going to be directing Wonder Woman. She directed and wrote and directed the movie Monster. She's one of my dearest, closest friends, like my sister, and we have crazy arguments. And it was basically about ghosts.
No, it wasn't. About 9 years of relationship history where you dated.
Yeah, and 20 years later, you know, apparently I'm still falling into the same traps of being condescending. In her mind, it was very interesting because I didn't think I was doing that.
Tweet at us if you think that Brian is ever condescending.
Yeah. Well, but here's the question: if somebody says something to you,
Brian, I ask you a question?
Yeah.
This argument that you're referencing got to about the worst place ever. Do you now want to like one-sidedly talk about that argument on air without Patty having a chance to respond?
No, because we made up and it was all good.
I understand.
We basically said, I don't want to be friends with you anymore. And then we were friends. And then we were like, come on. I mean, you know.
But do you now want to wade into that area on air without giving Patty a chance to respond? Or is this a time when discretion may be the better part of valor?
No. I wasn't even going to bring Patty into the idea. I was making it personal in that sense. But I was just actually going to talk about the broader idea of, you know, when somebody is at dinner, let's just take an example, and says, I think we need to get rid of capitalism in this country because of this banking bullshit and embrace a socialist system, or at least what Western Europe has. And when I hear that, of course, what happens to me is I hate the person a little bit. Like, I go, I don't agree with that. In fact, I find that offensive because I think the exact opposite is needed. Okay, so that I'm directly opposed or diametrically opposed, whatever, to that point of view. And I actually think that the argument is an important one. And maybe I'm using the wrong word, argument. Maybe it should be discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult for me to look at that person and not think you're part of the problem. Your thinking is part of a problem. Now, I don't know if that's the right approach, but what do I do in that situation? The problem a lot of times at dinner with intelligent people is somebody says something like that. And then it's more appropriate and polite if you want to keep harmony at the table to not really respond. However, if you voice that point of view, I find it fucking offensive. I do.
Well,
so I want to I want to at least say, well, I disagree, and here's why. And furthermore, that kind of thinking, I think, is going to create and make the problem even worse.
Well, I think that's the thing, is that, you know, the crucial word there is offensive, right? You take personal offense, you take it as, you
a
know.
Fight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think...
Isn't it?
Well,
isn't it?
I think it can turn into that.
No, but let me yeah. go further. Let me get extreme. So why do I... My hackles always raise when people start talking about psychics.
Right.
Okay, so I go see a psychic, which means she believes or he believes that somebody can predict the future.
Mm.
Now, instead of getting into whether or not there's measurable evidence of that and all that, I'd rather not. My problem with it is this, and I talked to you about you in the phone. I think whenever you have erroneous or irrational belief based on emotion and anecdotal evidence, which is what that is. Now, people could argue with that, but I don't think you could really come up with a very with hard, measurable science, because they've tried many times to prove that psychics are real. My mother, who's very scientifically minded, believes that there might be some truth to it. I don't know. But to predict the future, history and science and everything else would suggest probably not.
Right.
Probably don't go bet your entire life on what a psychic, wherever they are, regardless of the reputation, says. Because
I need to call my bookie really quickly.
Yeah. A little hard to predict the future. My issue is that same methodology, that mental methodology, that kind of thinking is exactly the kind of thinking people use to burn witches at the stake.
Can I provide a counterexample?
Yes.
Okay. Your father, right, yeah. the great Big Mike Callen, mm-hmm. Probably has a similar response when people start talking about global warming.
Yeah.
Right? And
that's emotional on his
that's
part.
That's incredibly emotional, but the point is that it's emotional for both sides, right? You know, there are also people who believe strongly about in global warming and will get offended if somebody starts denying global warming.
Okay, but because let me tell you the difference. I'm quiet about global warming typically because of two things. One, there is a lot of science to suggest that the globe is warming.
Right.
I don't know what that means. I also don't know, and I think the biggest question is that global warming a result of human activity? Or is it a pattern, or is it both? And then the question becomes, what mechanisms do we put into place, and how draconian should they be to stop this phenomenon, right?
But,
that's where the debate
or
discussion
should. But hold on, but I think that's, you know, you have had the privilege of interviewing Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, who wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt.
Yeah.
And the point is that you are in a position of doubt. And doubt is the same thing as being a global warming denier in terms of the actions that it leads to, because it leads to essentially no action.
Well, I'm not a doubter in that sense, and I'm not saying there should be no action. I'm really not.
But I think
what I'm saying is that I don't know enough about it, and so I'm erring on the side of caution, and I understand both points of view, because both points of view are coming at it. There is emotion involved, but you could make a scientific argument. I think that what you hear a lot of people who don't think there should be a lot done about global warming is they get a little skeptical of the models used in the science, etc.
Well, you know,
all.
In the same way that the tobacco scientists got real skeptical about
sure.
the models used. The point is that, you know, you can if you want to doubt, you can, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to believe that something's true or not true. And to be clear, most of the people who are on board with global warming have not looked at any of the evidence themselves, right? In general, most of us have certain opinions, and then we go and we cherry pick the data that we like,
mm-hmm.
right? In the same way that, you know, in terms of talking about ghosts or psychics, which I don't personally believe in, right? You're going to naturally gravitate towards the evidence that supports your point of view,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think regardless, we've reached a stage in society.
Ooh.
Oh, Jean-Pierre.
Hold on, Jean-Pierre's here.
Jean-Pierre will be here in a second.
That's Big Mike,
oh my God,
gentlemen.
Big Mike Callen.
Big Mike, a friend to the Brian Callen Show.
A man who just, well, we won't say your age, but
he's 75
venerable
and proud of it.
A venerable age.
Big Mike, a 75th birthday. How you feeling?
50th wedding anniversary.
Feeling like it's my 74th birthday.
I like it. We don't like this echo. Is there any way you can pick the phone up and talk directly into it?
We're using my polyphone. and maybe I should call again.
No, that's not a bad. That's not bad. That's
well,
a little.
I was maybe sitting too close to it.
Oh.
Now I'd like to introduce Jean-Pierre.
You can introduce Jean-Pierre. We still want to get the sound. Are we good, Rena, or how does that? Get a little closer to the mic. Let me hear you get a little closer, big mic.
Okay, I'm sitting here now.
Yeah, that's what we like. We like it close, just
well,
like that.
Well, that's where it's going to be because I was sitting at a, I was opening a window here.
Yeah, get all some, right, get some air. Get some air for all that hot air.
We had a very good session this morning with Jean-Pierre. Okay, I'm going to be sitting in his chair for just a second. I want to give you only a couple of highlights. When we met this gentleman and his family, you were taking baths, Brian, with his two sons, as was Kathleen. That was 1970, and it was in Beirut. They were living right above us, and he was with the Red Cross, the International Committee of the Red Cross at that time. Later, and I won't go into dates because we want to get to substance at the at a later point, Jean-Pierre became the High Commissioner at the United Nations for Refugees. That is a very responsible position at the UN. And I regret to say that because of his travels to places that most of us just read about in newspapers and would have been too wise to go to, thinking about the Sarajevos, I'm thinking about Vietnam during the wars, I'm thinking about the Iraq when the Iraq-Iran war was going on. And I'm mixing roles between his UN High Commission and the International Committee of the Red Cross, but he was looking after prisoners, going to every hotspot known to mankind. And then he asked, when he was, I'm going back at the UN for a second here, he asked Mikhail Gorbachev, a name that may be familiar to joined the commission, and the U.S. State Department took objection to that, and there ensued a series of rather unfortunate press reports and controversies with the U.S. government making claims which were totally untrue, and we started reading about Jean-Pierre in the New York Times, not always the most pleasant, and some of it actually actual slander. Now, the good news from all that is that because Jean-Pierre had been working with Senator Edward Kennedy, I can say that this, he will never say it. He was working with Senator Edward Kennedy, who came to be very appreciative of his many achievements, and with Alan Simpson, a Republican from Wyoming next door here, they introduced a resolution, specifically number 215, into the United States Senate that expressed appreciation of the United States Senate for all of Jean-Pierre's many, many achievements. And that sort of, not everybody thinks Ted Kennedy was the greatest, but people that dealt with him like Jean-Pierre have a very different opinion than press reports. So we were all very pleased to see that as a capstone to a illustrious career. And the last thing I'll say before handing it over to Jean-Pierre is that the interesting thing about the man as a friend over the last 40 years, 45 years, whatever it's been, is that he is a humanitarian in the genuine sense, speaking for my 75 years, in the sense that one has never met this is an unusual person. And also the fact is that he is as knowledgeable and aware of the important things going on in the world in great detail and is very concerned, given his character, about some of the trends. And that was amply explained this morning at the Romeo Group, the retired old men eating out. There were about 12 or 13, and they were all spelled out.
Retired old men eating out, the Romeo Group. Romeo. I love it. Retired old men eating out. Yes, I spoke now, there.
I am handing this phone over to Jean-Pierre, and I think I can tell you that he will give you however much time you you would like to have. You can talk about any part of the world. He is a very modest man, so that his dealings with people who are household names, I know for one that he dealt with Saddam Hussein over the treatment of Iranian prisoners during their war there. I know that he dealt with senior officials over the treatment of North Vietnamese prisoners, and that's probably a small part. And more recently, he's been in Sarajevo a lot, trying to sort out all of the implications of a war where the property was confiscated and so forth. He's got a long and illustrious career, and I was just talking to him about writing a book, but that's something else. Jean-Pierre, the floor is yours.
Well, there it is. I hope you can live up to that introduction, Jean-Pierre. And thanks for doing the show. You know, there's so many questions with a man who's had such scope and such experience. When you look back on your career, what do you think, what stands out for you? What are the things that you're the most proud of?
Well, sorry, now, I wouldn't, Brian, take it exactly from that viewpoint. Usually to be proud is not what is striking humanitarian workers most. First, it's usually so difficult just to get to the people you want to protect, to assist, to feed, to treat medically, and then it's even more difficult to secure ongoing access while a war is going up on, and so on, that most of the time you feel rather frustrated.
Right, yeah.
But coming back to a collective achievement, Mike was just speaking about Sarajevo. You know that in the early 90s until 1995, at the time of the Dayton Agreement, a war was raging in Bosnia-Herzegovina and was related very closely to ethnical cleansing. And in the end, there was this peace agreement, and the peace agreement not only resulted in the cessation of hostilities, but trying to set up a mechanism which would restore fully the independence of the country, and especially the right of the people living in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, one has to remember that Bosnia-Herzegovina is made, and especially at the end of the war, of three parties, the Serbs, the Croats, and the Muslims. And Dayton was wise enough to set up a number of commissions which were to look into the various aspects of restoring the right and the possibility to have a decent living. I was put in charge of chairing one commission, which was called the Commission on Property Right Claims, which enabled each Bosnians, whether in the country at the time or outside, to file a claim with our commission and to hope to be restored in his own right as an owner of a property on another. And this took us some 8 years to be completed, and it meant that someone who would have to leave at the time in a hurry would maybe just be left with a postal address or a telephone bill or an electricity bill. And starting with this kind of indication, we would like to come up with a file which would confirm that he was the right owner. And
that sounds like such a laborious. Obviously, it took 8 years. What a painstaking process. But I think you were successful in doing that for almost 1 million people, weren't you?
Yes.
Wow.
In the end, our commission handed out to individuals and families over 320,000 property titles.
Wow.
Which meant that these people could either go back to their property, to live in it, to lease it, or to sell it. And in this respect, I would say this was the really only time in all my career, if I may speak about the career, whether from the beginning to the end something could be completed and you could leave and saying the job has been accomplished.
Wow. And in all your time, it's funny that you say that, because when I think of the UN in general, and I think a lot of us, and especially, you know, the Red Cross, and, you know, when we have to deal with refugees, so much of what I think majority of people like myself who have access just to a newspaper or the news think about is, well, it's a huge mess. I'm sure there's somebody out there trying to help these people, and good luck. So whenever I think of Syria, I picture a group of people with their belongings on their back trying to cross a border and hunkering down in a tent and hoping for the best. And I guess that's that impossible situation with all its different dimensions is the kind of thing that you've had to face over and over again, trying to just get these people clean water, health care, etc., etc. It's got to be such a colossal challenge all the time.
True, it has always been, and it will always be like this. The big difference, and if one tries to put it in certain perspective, from, let's say, the end of Second World War up till now, I'm really concerned at the way it went down the drain. Remember that in 45-50, there was a big achievement further to the World War and its suffering and atrocities, that first the UN as an institution came up, and within the UN, a number of specialized agencies were also set up for dealing with refugees, with children, and so on and so forth. And this was done on a set of conventions. Speaking still about UN, you had specifically in 48 the Human Rights Declaration, which became a kind of a universal beacon. And whenever a government afterwards were to join UN, it had to adhere to this basis treaty and especially the Human Rights Charter. In subsequent sequences, you had what was going on during the so-called Cold War, and which is quite interesting, since during this time, and believe me, I am not, I am not regretting this time in the slightest way. But at least you had two superpowers, each of one pretending to be the best, each of one pretending to have an ethnical component superior to the other one, and you could draw on that. In other words, and I give you just two examples. One example was in 1982. When the situation in Central America was so bad, when especially in Salvador, things, when it came to political detention, were very bad in terms of detaining the people, treating the political detainees, and even killing them. It reached a point where the International Committee of the Red Cross nearly decided to suspend its activities since we couldn't correct the situation and improve the condition of the of these prisoners, even not, having to watch that whenever someone would be released, he would quit the prison, walk some 500 meters and be shot in the back, and it would be finished.
Jeez.
So that I went at that time to Washington, to the State Department, and said, listen, I'm here speaking on behalf of the committee, and you have to know that if nothing is changing, we shall quit Salvador.
Jean-Pierre, I want to stop you for a second. There's a sound. You keep, somebody's hitting something. What's going on there?
That's Jean-Pierre.
Of course, I never managed to speak without my hand.
Just keep them a little higher because you're banging on the thing and we can hear it. That's fine. I want to stop you for a second because you're raising something, a very important point. There are times when it gets so bad, and I'm thinking of Rwanda, and you're giving us an example from 1982. Where a government is killing its own people, or there's terrible civil war, but not even civil war. In Rwanda, there really was a group of just these groups of men in trucks killing Hutus. I'm sorry, Tutsis. The majority of these Hutu extremists were killing, you know, moderate Hutus and Tutsis and things like that. I understand that you are in a position where you can say, look, we're going to suspend activity, but isn't there a time that you need some kind of a rapid reaction force? Doesn't the UN have an obligation when things get too egregious to put some people with big guns on the ground to take out the people that are doing this kind of stuff, or at least make them pay a price with their lives or militarily? I know it's not in your field, but when does that happen? When in your mind, where is a red line? Is there a red line? When do we do that?
I shall come to it immediately, but let me just finish in a yes. few sentences what I said before.
Yes.
So that the people I met at the State Department said, especially one, listen, in 2 days I'm going down to Salvador. I'm going down with the number three of the Pentagon. We shall look into the matter. And they were actually really doing something so that a few weeks afterward the situation improved dramatically and ICRC could go on. There is another instance which shows what I said before, that you could go to either of the superpower and try to correct on the ground the situation, especially when it came to these so-called wars by proxy. Mm-hmm. As second example I give you very briefly is the war which raged in Angola at the time, and nearly at the same time then Central America in 83, there was a big question in getting seeds to the Plan Alto, which was held by Savimbi, which opposed the central government. And here also we met the greatest difficulty in convincing the president of Angola to let us do the job. I managed to go to Cuba and see Fidel Castro, who knows had not only medical personnel in vast numbers, but some military personnel, and said, here is a situation, this cannot be condoned, and something has to be done. And he, too, as well, took action, and after 3 weeks, the seeds could reach the Plan Alto. Just to show you that on both sides, there was an actual possibility to act and to impose something, thanks to those who were protecting whatever side. Now, your question is precisely dealing, I would say, with the next phase, further to the end of the Cold War, where basically, I would say, Soviet Union, as you know, disappeared. One wouldn't hear very much in the international field, and especially in these conflicts, about them. The United States claimed through Reagan they had defeated the Soviet Union, and as far as they were concerned, they couldn't do any harm when it came to the respect of international humanitarian convention, since the United States was a democracy. So this meant in actual term that when it came to these local conflicts in Africa, in Asia, and in a few other places, the big powers no longer were very interested of what would happen and how long it would go on, you know?
Yeah.
This is the reason why, for instance, in the Congo, it started at that time, and it's still going on.
Yeah.
You speak about Rwanda, this tragedy in 1984, where over 100 days, some possibly 600,000 to 800,000 people were slaughtered, and over 1 million of Rwandan ended up in the Congo. Would it have been possible to prevent it? If you go by the international law, I'm not speaking about international law, but the rules guiding the Security Council, such an action, the way you imagine, can only happen with the consent of the Security Council. And you know how difficult it is to get there a decision.
I know.
In the meantime, the disaster is allowed to spread. This led precisely at the same time, as it was in the late 80s, some French initiative called Le Droit d'Ingérence, the right to intervene. He resulted in a resolution, but it was so badly explained and outlined and to some degree imposed, and not enough discussion was allowed within the General Assembly, that immediately the South considered this resolution as a new instrument which was aimed at oppressing them, at attacking their sovereignty. And from the start on, this resolution was really defied. And it was defied by the worst dictators.
Right.
The president of Sudan, Bashar, who, you know what he did in western Sudan, where also hundreds of thousands of people were killed. What happened on the border with South Sudan and so on and so forth. So something which was meant really to try to prevent the recurrence of events like the one in Rwanda, in international law and regulation, was not working. Since increasingly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was full speed resumption of the intangibility of national sovereignty.
But doesn't the structure of the UN allow for that, in the sense that, I mean, if I'm a sub-Saharan African dictator, which I am, it's one of my side jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's very easy for me to point at the structure of the UN. You know, everybody has a seat where they get to basically talk, and then these five nations get total veto power. It's not exactly very representative. You know, it isn't truly a proportional international body. Isn't it? I mean, doesn't that make that fairly easy? You know, and do we need to recognize, oh, okay, we're in a new stage? You know, the UN was mainly set up to promote discussion. You know, one of its primary functions was to allow the Soviets and the Americans to have a format in which they could talk. Do we maybe need a new kind of international body?
this I don't know exactly, but I feel that we are heading progressively towards a situation where the UN will be seen so paralyzed when it comes to these awful and basic issues of human abuses, ethnic cleansing, sheer destruction of whole countries, that in the end, coming back to the humanitarian field, the four Geneva Convention protecting prisoners of war, wounded prisoners, and civilian population living under occupation, which were a real achievement in 1949, and which was a battle fought over close to 150 years, will become inoperative.
What about creating safe zones the way we did with the Kurds in the north in Iraq? I mean, there has to be a role. I feel like the United Nations, NATO, I guess, someone has to say, I just believe in this kind of action where if I see a bunch of people, a million people, being forced to migrate across a country with their clothing on their backs and with people hot on their tail trying to kill them, Sudan's an example. I just, for me, as emperor of the world, I would say, all right, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to create a huge safe zone for these people to live in.
And where are you going to get those troops from?
Well,
because the U.S. has...
I would create a NATO reaction force, a NATO army of sorts, and their directive would be to provide protection the way we did for the Kurds. It was very, very effective. And so I know I'm being naive now. I know that's a logistical nightmare and everything else, but I don't know what other way there is to stop this kind of situation other than to take the profit out of this kind of behavior for dictators. I mean, I know this is an old debate and what do we do, but man, I mean, talking about it and condemning it doesn't work. People like you, and you've given examples, do make a difference, thank God. And as you said, there is a downside in some ways to having only one superpower, because at least when you had two superpowers, you could play them off each other to help the people in need. And now when you have one superpower, there's no longer a need to prove what a great guy you are. So your job would be even more difficult maybe. But don't you, and I'm sure this played in a great deal into your frustration, Jean-Pierre. But I, what do you think about that? What do you think about creating militarized safe zones when it gets that bad?
As you said, when it came to Iraq, in the first stage, when there was a no-fly zone imposed to Saddam to protect not only the Kurds, but other civilian population, it worked. But there has been, for instance, right now, no political will to impose a same flight no-fly zone over Syria.
Right.
And then Bashar has been allowed for now 4 years to use his aerial superiority not only to kill people but to destroy half, if not more, of his country. So all that means, what I said before, that you have a progressive decay of this international system made of institution plus international public law, which has been set up in the late 40s and who was meant to avoid the repetition of what happened in the case of the first two world wars. And now we are, in my view, heading again towards a similar situation, and this is due basically to a lack of the political will to do or to try to act in the way you suggest.
My guess is that you're probably pretty critical of Barack Obama and his, you know, because we had Joseph Nye on, who I believe is out of Harvard. He's a political scientist, and he was the one who coined the term soft power. And he wrote, his most recent book argues that prudent presidents, cautious presidents, generally fare better historically than do presidents willing to intervene more vigorously. And it sounds to me like, and you've heard a lot of criticism, you know, Barack Obama has been criticized for not having a lot of political will, not necessarily choosing a side. And Syria is a good example of that. What do you think of that?
Well, it's not that I'm not willing to discuss about Barack Obama, but it goes much further up, which means one has to transcend the presidency and precisely to see over a period of 20, 30, 40 years how the general trend has been.
Mm.
And the general trend is that, and I put that specifically into the 80s and early 90s, and in this respect, Rwanda was a very good example, that government, knowing that it was so difficult either to set up a prevention operation or to try to deal and resolve politically the issue in Rwanda, that they throw a lot of money to the humanitarian organization, and the aim was that the humanitarian organization could give them time in looking for a solution, but increasingly I came to the conclusion giving them time not to do the slightest effort to solve it,
right,
until it is solved by itself on the spot, you know, since the challenges were definitely no longer the same like during the Cold War. The further question today is to say, is that still really one superpower? Is it not that this multipolar world some describe becomes more and more a reality, and that while violence is allowed to develop the way we see now in the Middle East and in other places, those in power, whoever they are, still try to have an armed response to fight violence through violence, but strictly no effort in parallel done in saying, if we let it go, as I said, this will end up in sheer disaster, and what from now on have we to plan, to discuss, to try to get government and people, given the present world outlook, together in order to, if not adjust, but possibly even to set up a new world order, but a true one, and which where problems of violence wouldn't be solved by violence, but would be solved by, again, a major political effort, and when I say political, it will embrace many aspects of what all this means, including working for the rebuilding of the destroyed states and restoring.
You know, Jean-Pierre, I can't help but to feel like you're talking the way a lot of people were speaking, though, when they justified the invasion of Iraq to an extent. In other words, let's get an international coalition in here, let's get rid of the bad guy Saddam Hussein, and let's come back in and let the people be free and restore and create a democracy
in Iraq.
But Brian,
then you're trapped between the rock and the hard place that the whole world is trapped behind, because you want an international force that's going to go in and stop the bad guys. But then as soon as you want to set up that international force, you're like, wait a minute,
hold on. That's what I mean. Well, that's why I'm saying to Jean-Pierre, like, I wonder, though, if that that is even possible, I guess is what I'm saying, Jean-Pierre. Is it even possible to create a new world order?
But Brian, you always think in terms of a military force.
Right.
All these military force coalition, if you take them today in the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya.
Right.
They don't work.
They don't work. They don't seem to work. We go in, we get rid of the quote unquote dictator, and then the whole country breaks into civil war. So it hasn't worked, has it? Yeah.
No. What is not working when the dictator has left? How can you imagine that a proper opposition can get organized, can plan what to do after the dictator will have left, when in a country like Syria, since 1970, you have a dictator who is just making sure that whatever opposition would be allowed to get organized inside the country, where people would be arrested, tortured, killed. So there is no surprise if in Libya, if in Iraq, and tomorrow in Syria, you have a big mess.
Yeah.
But it's precisely here, as I say, knowing that there is going to be a big mess, you have to make effort to nevertheless try progressively to come out with a political solution. If you take Yemen, the talks were set up in Geneva a few days ago and which failed, including through fighting in the room between the opposition and the so-called legal government.
Physical fighting?
Yeah.
Wow.
Shows how difficult it is.
Yeah.
But the effort will go on, you know?
So when you speak of a new world order, you're not speaking militarily. You're speaking of something else. Dial it on that a little bit more.
Going back to the past, I would say it is well known today that in the United States and also some part of Europe, but especially in the United States, at the beginning of Second World War, and already as far back as 1941, a number of people started to say, when this Second World War will be over, what will we have to imagine? How would we have to be ready in order to reset something which will be working and permit Europe and other part of the world to be allowed to go back on their feet? And that concretely resulted for Europe in the Marshall Plan. And without this Marshall Plan, where would be Europe today? It resulted also in the mind of a French guy called Jean Monnet, who is the one who imagined at that time what Europe should be, and resulted in the Schuman Declaration of the 9th May of 1950, and so on. You know, you cannot let violence go on while sitting idle and saying, "Oh, we'll see what will happen, how will be the outcome, and so on," and the sheer fact that this hasn't been done now for some year, the sheer fact that the West, as a whole, bet always on the dictator, more or less benevolent or brutal. When these people go, and the dictatorship has one way or the other one to go and collapse, that nothing today is ready. And since nothing is ready, and since like in Syria, one has to understand that very well, who is attracting, who is the force who has allowed ISIS to progress the way they have been done? It's Bashar. It's not the other way around.
Really?
Yeah. And this is, no, so to speak, no one understands, at least in the public opinion.
Yeah, explain that.
I explain that. A dictatorship is disruptive. A dictatorship doesn't allow, as I said before, the constitution of a proper opposition.
Right.
It's more and more precisely destructive. It's more and more brutal. Hence, there is a reaction.
Yes. Yes.
Right, but now, be it in Syria, be it in so many places in the Middle East, the Bashar regime for years and years is unacceptable. And the Bashar regime is basically supported by the West, has been supported by Israel, and given the development in Iraq, where half of the population of the Sunni deprived of their normal right of citizens, even if they abused it before against the Shia, I fully agree. But since the West didn't succeed in convincing the new authority really to set up a large base, broad national government, the part here, the Sunni, which were let down,
created ISIS.
Allowed ISIS to develop, and eventually, having no alternative, started to support. And ISIS, with their crazy ideas and so on, came out with the caliphate, and decided that this caliphate would engulf Western Iraq and Syria.
So then it sounds to me like you're calling for, if there is a dictatorship, and let's take Syria as an example, or Iraq for that matter, rather than going in with a military approach, what would be better is if the international community withdrew their support.
I would say let's not dwell too much on the past, but what is happening now, I think those who have followed the situation in Iraq and Syria, not to speak in other places, knew that it would happen this way. ISIS eventually started in 2004, was allowed to develop, and it's not from one day to the other in 2014 that they, coming from nowhere, succeeded in conquering the west of Iraq, Anbar and so on, and today have control over some 6 million people at least. This has been built up regularly year after year, and nothing has been done. So I would say today, one thing is to say one should have acted before, but since government and the international community didn't act it, let's start from the present situation, and as I said, let's take each situation for what it is and see what could and should be done in order to reach eventually, how long it takes.
When you say they should have acted before, what do you mean by they should have acted before?
But as I said, in Iraq, to insist that this broad-based national government, including Shia and Sunni, actually would really be put in place and be operated.
But if we insist and they persist in doing what they want, then what?
Step by step, my friend. but at least let's have a proper assessment right now of where we come from, why we are in this situation, what has to be stopped, and how to defuse the way ISIS is allowed to progress, and to know that this also will have to do with the departure of the Assad regime.
I think that I would find myself, as I probably, if I was on in that group, and I have no business being there, I would probably be calling for guns and bombs. And I know that's not the only way. But
if we were to establish a no-fly zone in Syria,
yeah,
right? I mean, that's going to require bombs and guns.
Yeah.
So you need both.
I guess what you're saying also, Jean-Pierre, is every situation is different and every situation has to be analyzed critically. And prudence is important in the beginning, and finding out if there's another solution other than guns and bombs is first order.
It's not only that there is a other solution than guns and bombs. Guns and bombs in the long run cannot be the solution.
Right.
Mm. But I think that's the big idea here.
But I think regardless, right, I think I think what you've really identified is that, you know, whatever you're going to do, you require political will and a lot of it. And there's been a lot less political will since the end of the Cold War.
Exactly. Mm. Since immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall, one was speaking about a new world order. And this was 1989. Now we are in 2015. And nothing showed up, nothing came up. No one is working in trying to see what this world order should be. And not only in relation, I would say, to these conflict situation, but again, the background of all basic challenges mankind is confronted today, you know? Yeah.
Well, but Hunter and I are always talking about how in today's world, when you make a stand and when you talk about the difference between the right way and the wrong way, or even good and evil, or just whatever it is, it becomes rather gauche. We do live in a relativist's paradise in some ways, you know. I mean, it's very, very gauche to kind of say, well, this is wrong and we need to do this, or here's a solution. And maybe that's what we're suffering
because
from.
I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, we actually were talking about this earlier, but we had two authors of a book called Merchants of Doubt. And the point is that doubt has been created, you know, first they created doubt around, you know, the dangers of smoking, and now there is doubt around global warming. And the great thing about doubt and confusion is that they allow you to not act. And I think, you know, the danger is that, yes, obviously a situation like Syria is complicated, but as long as you allow it to be like, oh, it's so complicated, that allows you to do nothing.
Yeah.
And the fact is that while the facts on the ground may be complicated, while there may be many sides, the reality that there are, you know, a million people displaced. Something needs to be done.
Yeah. Action. Jean-Pierre?
I do agree. Yet, what action?
What action?
And that's the reason why I come to the basic challenge in facing mankind in the not only coming years, but coming centuries. One of the most important one in my view is demography. Mm. And demography problems linked to the economic development is starting to hit as well the West and especially Europe. When you have in country like Spain 40% of unemployment for people under 35, whatever their diplomas, something is wrong. If you take Egypt, how can you imagine the condition in economic condition in Egypt, which would allow a majority of Egyptians to have a job and a proper living, knowing that you have today, I think, close to 90 million people, and where 60 to 70 of these 90 million people are under 35. Imagine the time bomb.
Yeah.
Thirdly, we know that in a few years' time, if we go on the way where we have our models today, 75% of the world population is going to live in cities. So how do you give them job? How do you set up the facilities and so on? You know?
Big challenges.
These are much bigger time bomb even than what happened right now in Syria and so on.
But in some sense, they're
affecting everyone.
But that's the thing is that what's happening in Syria is a reflection of that. When you have a bunch of unemployed young men, they find something to do, you know, whatever it is. And that's always been the central challenge of history, is how to take all of the energy that young men have and put it towards something constructive rather than destructive. Yeah.
Jean-Pierre, I know this is the second long interview you've done, so we thank you for your time. We don't want to. I know you're in Utah. You're hanging out with my parents. So we'll let you get back to what you were doing. I obviously, I could talk to you for hours, but we don't want to take too much of your time. We appreciate it.
Okay. But you know, now I will have a new challenge to face with your father, who will be going on treating me as an incredible communist.
That's right, my friend. That's what happens when you deal with Big Mike Callan. Well, listen, Jean-Pierre, set the man straight. Set the man straight.
This being Brian, I would like to say one thing.
Yes, sir.
Last night, we watched with your parent your show in Los Angeles. I think you need which one?
Your Showtime special.
Ah, yes. I apologize for that in advance. Yes.
No, don't apologize. It was magnificent, and really, congratulations. We have been, with Michelle, so impressed.
Thank you. Well,
they only fell asleep three times.
I coming from you, that means a lot, and especially in your eloquent Swiss French accent. I feel like recording that and just keeping it on a loop. That might be my ringtone on my cell phone. It was magnificent. Jean-Pierre Oquet, High Commissioner, former High Commissioner for Refugees, United Nations, and I believe Director of Operations at the International Red Cross. Thank you for making the time. Thank you for making the world a better place, and I hope to see you soon in person.
And Brian, if you behave yourself, I will produce more of my impressive friends.
We need more of your friends. We need more of you, my friend. So we appreciate it. You guys go on and enjoy your day.
We shall speak to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Awesome. Well, I think if I could speak this way, I kept waiting for him to say in that wonderful accent, I kept waiting for Jean-Pierre to say, and finally, I must kill you now. You know what I mean? He sounded like a bad guy in a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
But
I also enjoyed, like, I mean, you know, there were, like, when he said adhere, he dropped the H, so it was adhere.
Adhere. Yeah, he's a real class act. Jean-Pierre Oquet is a really classy man. I've known him since I was a little kid, and my father was always so impressed with him.
And when Big Mike is impressed by a communist, that is really an accomplishment.
You know he's a badass. Those are big challenges, man.
But I think,
you know, and I just think action is important.
But I think that's the thing, is that, you know, before you can have action, you have to have political will. And before you can have political will, I think you really need some sort of new international institution.
Yeah, but you have to also win the argument. Before you can have political will, you have to, this is what I was talking about. An argument has to happen. A discussion has to
100%.
Happen. 100%. And if you, if the right, I want to create a no-fly zone over Syria.
Right.
That's a charged statement that I better be able to defend and, more importantly, win over. I got to win that argument. I have to, because if I'm going to get people in a room who make decisions to agree with me, I've got to win the argument with a better idea. Not easy to do, man. Not easy to do with the way human beings are wired.
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, I think that's the question, is that, you know, there, you know, we went through, you know, you had colonialism, right? And the world, you know, the Western powers believed that they had the best system and therefore you could impose it on other countries.
Yeah.
Well, then we were like, okay, maybe that's not true. Then you come to World War II, you have a battle between two systems. At the end of World War II, everybody agrees that fascism is the worst system, right? And then you have the battle between democracy and communism, right? Democracy wins. You know, there are a bunch of people who sort of are like, well, communism didn't work, but I still secretly think it would be a better system to redistribute more wealth. And then finally, you get to the modern age where there's democracy, and then there's the Chinese system and the Russian system, other forms of totalitarianism, which essentially are saying, we're going to trade political rights for prosperity.
Yeah.
And, you know, that conversation is being had in certain
circles.
There's
also another argument, a smaller argument with fundamentalism, but that's kind of lost. That's already lost.
I think the problem is that that's incredibly compelling to a small number of people and not to the majority of people. I mean, the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood is Islam is the solution.
Yeah. Well, okay. And Hunter Motz, once again, putting everything in perspective, we got to wrap this up, but finish your thought.
Well, what I was going to say is I think that, yes, absolutely, agreeing with you, Brian Callen, yes, anding in the grand tradition of improv. I think that's the thing. We do have to have a, you know, the world has to reach some conclusions about what the best systems are and there in what situations you can intervene.
Yeah.
And I think, you know.
And I'll make it real simple for you. When a million women and children or old people are going to die and are getting bombed and tortured and raped, fuck that. That's where I get so angry. That's all I need to hear. At least create a safe zone, a no-flight zone. If you're in the Congo and they're coming in and burning babies, well, no. That's all I need to hear. Let's create a safe zone with guns.
That's the problem with the United States trying to be the policeman of the world is you go into a place like Afghanistan or you go into a place like Iraq, and then the United States doesn't have the political will to support that. But if you'd actually distributed some of that responsibility and there was some sort of international community.
There's a way to do it.
I think there is, but I think the world has to come together enough to say there are things that are not acceptable, and in that case, we will commit troops, but the whole thing has to be proportional based on either income or population so that, you know, we are taking on appropriate levels of responsibility. And that way, when a group goes in, you're not saying, oh, it's the U.S. imposing its foreign policy on everyone. It's like, no, this is something that the world has agreed upon.
There it is. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Callen, Hunter Motz Show.
Yeah. By the way, we did have a discussion that was going on before Jean-Pierre called in that we didn't finish. And I do want to say, I think that's the point. I think that the society has now gotten so complicated. Like, our world is so complicated that we have to have a new style of discussion. We can't rely on the old style of discussion where we're trying to win arguments.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to, like, be looking at the facts and letting the facts win on their own merits.
I agree. That sounds like science to me.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. We got to get out of here.
Thank you to Brian Callen for everything you do for the world.
Come on, guys. I'm just the bridge. Punchline Comedy Club this weekend.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.